Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're listening to a talk by Ron Bailey on a panel at the Association for Politics and Life Sciences meeting that occurred on September 1, 2005 in Washington, D.C. The panel was on transhumanism. Ron's responding to some criticisms of transhumanism on the basis of his perspective and his book, Liberation Biology.
So Ron can respond for the transhumanists.
Okay, I will respond to the transhumanists. Well, first of all, I will say this, Larry, we can do it, yes. Yeah. And should we do it? Yes. So I am responding in that regard. First, I want to say two things, and I'm doing in the book Liberation Biology is explaining at least some of the technologies currently available and some of the technologies that are just over the horizon that will be used to affect some of these changes that we're talking about, like longer, healthier lives, more intelligent children, that kind of thing. And they're crude, but I want to give you a hint in the book of how these things are going to be happening and are already being used. And then I also go on to look at some of the arguments, the policy arguments and the moral arguments as to why we should allow these kinds of things, and it is basically a libertarian take on it. That's quite true. So the title of my particular talk will be here is a takeoff on a Frank Fukuyama article in the Foreign Policy of September, October 2004, where he decided that transhumanism was the most dangerous idea. He was asked the question, what ideas, if embraced, would pose... I should come to think of that. I better turn that off myself. See, if you could just install it in your head, no one would know. Fukuyama was asked, what ideas, if embraced, would pose the greatest threat to the welfare of humanity? Fukuyama's idea was transhumanism. So what is transhumanism? Well, I think the World Transhumanist Association offers a pretty comprehensive definition. Transhumanism promotes the interdisciplinary approach to understanding and evaluating the opportunities for enhancing the human condition and the human organism opened up by the advancement of technology. Attention is given to both present technologies like genetic engineering and information technology and anticipated future ones such as molecular nanotechnology and artificial intelligence. They are, in fact, looking at how technology will be used to improve and, yes, radically extend aspects of human nature. What I'm going to do in this particular talk, though, is again, take a look over the horizon and then perhaps have a few remarks with regard to transcendence. We'll see where we're going with that. Fukuyama, in his article, identifies transhumanism as, quote, a strange liberation movement that wants, quote, nothing less than to liberate the human race from its biological constraints. Really sounds ominous, right? Ooh. But wait a minute. I mean, isn't human history and prehistory all about liberating more and more people from their biological constraints? After all, we're not sitting here, you know, with spears and bear skins. We're in a room with digital technology, lighting, so forth. So it's not as though we're still living in our natural state as Pleistocene hunter-gatherers. Human liberation for our biological constraints began when our first ancestor sharpened a stick and killed an animal for food. Further liberation for biological constraints followed with fire, the wheel, domesticating animals, agriculture, metallurgy, city building, textiles, information storage by means of writing, the internal combustion engine, electric generation of power, you know, our world, basically. In a sense, the goal toward which humanity has been striving for millennia has been to liberate ourselves from more and more of our ancestors' biological constraints. And then, what is a human capacity anyway? What is it that people want to expand? Richard Dawkins, the biologist Richard Dawkins, has propounded the notion of an extended phenotype. Genes not only mold bodies of organisms, but also shape their behaviors. Some of those behaviors result in the creation of inanimate objects that help organisms to survive and reproduce, such as beaver dams and bird's nests. Our ancestors had no wings, yet we fly. Our ancient forebears could not hear one another over 100 miles. Now we telephone. And our Stone Age progenitors averaged a life expectancy of 25 years. Now we live 75 years. So thanks to our knack for technological innovation, humanity has by far the largest extended phenotype of all the creatures on planet Earth, and it's only going to get bigger. And there's nothing more natural to human beings than striving to liberate ourselves from our biological constraints. There is nothing more natural than trying to liberate ourselves from our biological constraints.
What was that?
But Fukuyama would undoubtedly respond that the Pleistocene hunter-gatherers were recognizably human. They were not different in their innate capacities of people living today. And that what transhumanists seek is very different, that they want to go beyond current innate human capacities. They want to change human bodies and brains. And that is true. Guilty as charged. But of course, humans have been deliberately changing their bodies through athletic training and their brains through schooling. You know, it's normal. Nevertheless, Fukuyama does have a point. Can one be so transformed by technology as to be no longer human? Quote, our good characteristics are intimately connected to our bad ones. This is from Fukuyama. If we weren't violent and aggressive, we wouldn't be able to defend ourselves. If we didn't have feelings of exclusivity, we wouldn't be loyal to those close to us. If we never felt jealousy, we would also never feel love. He seems to be arguing that a human being must possess all of the emotional capacities characteristic of our species, that he has a notion of human nature, which he calls the X factor, because he actually can't really define it very well. And he's afraid that if biological manipulations removed our ability to feel emotions like anger, hate, or violence, we would in some sense not be human beings anymore. Well, let's say that genetic engineers discover a gene for suicidal depression and learn how to suppress that gene or adjust it. Would fixing it make all subsequent generations non-human beings? After all, most people today do not fall into suicidal depressions, and those happy people are no less human than, say, the famously morose poet Sylvia Plath. Depression can also be fixed, can already be fixed in many people by means of Prozac or Paxil. Surely taking serotonin reuptake inhibitors does not make people other or less than human. Sufferers of depression will tell you that the drugs restore them to their true selves. It seems unreasonable to claim that in order to qualify as human beings, we all must have the capacity to succumb to berserker rage or religious ecstasy. The first, and I quote Fukuyama again, the first victim of transhumanism might be equality. If we start transforming ourselves into something superior, what rights will these enhanced creatures claim? And what rights will they possess when compared to those left behind? Fukuyama seems to be entertaining an X-Men likes the movie X-Men, the comic series X-Men, scenario in which enhanced posthumans seek to destroy unenhanced naturals. But where Fukuyama is a bit coy in that article, left-leaning bioethicists George Annis, Laurie Andrews, and Rosario Isasi are brutally blunt in their 2002 article, Protecting the Endangered Human, toward an international treaty prohibiting cloning and other inheritable alterations, available online at the American Journal of Law and Medicine for your meeting edification. And I quote them now, the new species, or post-human, will likely view the old, normal humans as inferior, even savages, fit for slavery or slaughter. Well, I guess that's a Nietzschean extremism view there. The normals, on the other hand, may see the post-humans as a threat, and if they can, engage in a preemptive strike by killing the post-humans before they themselves are killed or enslaved by them. It is ultimately this predictable potential for genocide that makes species-altering experiments potential weapons of mass destruction and makes the unaccountable genetic engineer a potential bioterrorist. So tell me what you really think.
I don't think I want to sit by you.
But let's take this over-the-top scenario down a little bit here. The enhancements that are likely to be available in the relatively near term to people who are now living will be pharmacological pills and shots to increase strength, lighten moods, and improve memory. Consequently, such interventions could be distributed nearly to everybody who wanted them. Later in this century, when safe genetic engineering becomes possible, it will enable parents to give their children beneficial genes for improved health and intelligence that other children already get naturally. They already have them. It's not as though we're creating something completely new. Thus, safe genetic engineering in the medium run is more likely to ameliorate rather than exacerbate human inequality. In any case, political equality has never rested on the facts of human biology. In prior centuries, when all humans were all naturals, tyranny, slavery, the casual subjugation of women were common social and political arrangements. In fact, political liberalism is already an answer to, I would suggest, Fukuyama's question about human and post-human rights. In liberal societies, the law is meant to apply equally to all, no matter how rich or poor, powerful or powerless, brilliant or stupid, enhanced or unenhanced. One of the crowning achievements of the Enlightenment is the principle of tolerance, of putting up with people who look differently, talk differently, worship differently, and live differently than we do. In the future, our descendants may not all be natural Homo sapiens, but they will still be moral beings who can be held accountable for their actions. And that's what I think a moral being is someone or some creature that can be held accountable, who understands the reasons for their behavior. But we can talk about whether that will work. There's no reason to think that the same, I think anyway, there's no reason to think the same liberal political and moral principles that apply to diverse human beings today wouldn't apply to relations among future humans and post-humans. What if unenhanced post-humans did take the Nietzschean Superman option? What if they really did see unenhanced people as inferior, even savages, and fit for slavery or slaughter? Well, it's a concern, but let's face it, plenty of unenhanced humans have been quite capable of believing that millions of their fellow unenhanced humans were inferiors who needed to be eradicated. I was just looking up a wonderful website on human slaughter. I think governments killed 160 million people in the 20th century just for fun. However, as liberal political institutions have spread and strengthened, they have increasingly restrained technologically superior groups from automatically wiping out less advanced peoples, which was the usual practice in most of human history. I suspect that this dynamic will continue in the future as biotechnology, nanotechnology, computational technologies progressively increase people's capacities and widen their choices. In his famous essay, The End of History, and of course, history got restarted because of biotechnology, Fukuyama declared that we are, quote, witnessing the endpoint of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. Fair enough. I actually agree. But for Fukuyama, the end of history is, quote, a sad time because, quote, daring, courage, imagination, and idealism will be replaced by economic calculation. Also, he claims, quote, in the post-historical period, there will be neither art nor philosophy, just a perpetual caretaking of the museum of human history. How ironic that Fukuyama now spends his time demonizing transhumanism, a nascent philosophical and political movement that epitomizes the most daring, courageous, imaginative, and idealistic aspirations of humanity. But before concluding, let me take a brief look at the aspect of unfolding biotech revolution that disturbs thinkers like Fukuyama the most, the prospect of immortality, or if not immortality, dramatically increased lifespans. The prospect of physical immortality fills environmentalist writer Bill McKibben, the author of the 2003 book Enough: Staying Human in an Engineered Age, with, quote, the blackest foreboding. Leon Cass, the head of the President's Council of Bioethics, asserts the finitude of human life is a blessing for every individual, whether he knows it or not. And then Daniel Callahan, the founder of the Hastings Center, arguably the world's first bioethics center, has declared, quote, there is no known social good coming from the conquest of death. He added, the worst possible way to resolve the question of life extension is to leave it up to individual choice. And when asked if the government has the right to tell its citizens that they have to die, Fukuyama answered, yes, absolutely. So, first, it will not be as easy to retard aging as we might hope. I agree that there are technical limitations, but let's face it, biology is matter. We're not talking about vitalism. We're not talking about any incorporeal things that are hard to get a hold of. It is an engineering problem, and all engineering problems are subject to being solved at some point. And I think that in 150 years, when we're having this conversation again, you'll say, Ron, you were right back then. But anyway. But even the President's Council on Bioethics acknowledges in its report, Beyond Therapy, Biotechnology in Pursuit of Happiness, and I want to stress this, it seems increasingly likely that something like age retardation is in fact possible. And a response to the Struhlbrug argument basically is that the point of all this technology is not to get older longer. It's to be younger longer. No one would want to be a Struhlbrug. These notions that these people keep opponents come up with is we're just going to be, you know, a nursing home world. That's not on. That's not what people are striving for. And I think that
that's what they're getting.
Actually, if you want to look at it, the fact of the matter is that the people in any age cohort in the United States are much better off than the previous generation was. The fact that someone age 75 actually acts physically and mentally like someone who's 65. And you can look that up on the websites at the Health and Human Services Department. So the fact is that we're not getting that. And in fact, the number of people going into nursing homes is declining as a percentage of the population of their generation. So I think that that's a wrong analysis. Empirically. But anyway, that being said, so why does McKibben believe, and these other people, believe that death is good for us? But McKibben says, without mortality, no time. All moments would be equal. The deep, sad human wisdom of Ecclesiastes would vanish. If for everything there is an endless season, then there is also no right season. The future stretches before you endlessly flat. Well, I went back and reread my Ecclesiastes, and I think the preacher had something else to say in that regard. I think Ecclesiastes is a very powerful human response to the existential dread of oblivion that stretches endlessly before the dead. As the preacher wrote, "For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun." I would like to suggest to you that if death is not inevitable, most people will be happy to spend the extra time granted them to learn glad new teachings and deeper new wisdom. If, however, the endless future turns out to be as horrible as McKibben imagines it might be, then people will undoubtedly choose to give up their empty, meaningless lives. On the other hand, if people opt to live yet longer, wouldn't that mean that they had found ample enough pleasure, joy, love, and yes, meaning to keep them going? McKibben's right. We don't actually know what immortality would be like, but should that happy choice become available through biomedical progress, each of us can still decide whether we want to enjoy it or not. My libertarian attitude. If you want to die, go ahead. You first. Besides, even if the ultimate goal of the biotechnological quest is immortality, what it will be immediately on offer is only longevity. The experience of longer lives will give humanity an opportunity to see how it works out. If longer lives do become meaningless, then surely people will not choose longer, meaningless lives. In a sense, if immortality is the problem, it is a self-correcting problem. Death is always an option. Then turning to Leon Cass. Leon Cass has argued that, quote, immortality is a kind of oblivion, like death itself. He adds, quote, mortality as such is not our defect, nor is bodily immortality our goal. Rather, immortality is at most a pointer, a derivative manifestation, or an accompaniment of some deeper deficiency. The human soul yearns for, longs for, aspires to some condition, some state, some goal toward which our earthly activities are directed, but which cannot be attained in earthly life. Man longs not so much for deathlessness as for wholeness, wisdom, goodness, and godliness. Kind of hard for me to figure out exactly why living longer wouldn't give you wholeness, wisdom, goodness, and godliness as a possible thing to seek after, but anyway. But taking Cass on his own terms, what can he mean by asserting that immortality would be a kind of oblivion? Keep in mind, whatever the risks of oblivion posed by immortality, they surely must be balanced against the certain oblivion of the grave. Cass points to the frivolity of the lives of the gods in Greek myths. Nothing is serious to them because eternity stretches endlessly before them. Their choices are whimsical and capricious. It is all just a game, and mortals are no more real significance to them than mosquitoes are to us. Do these myths provide a warning, a real warning, to heedless humanity about the pursuit of immortality? I don't think so. One problem with the Greek gods as cautionary models is they existed in an eternity with no progress, no goals other than playing the same endless round of games among themselves. Many visionaries, such as James Hughes here, who argued for dramatically extending human lifespans, do foresee a day when people can use technology to become very much like gods, with vast new abilities to apprehend new knowledge and achieve new goals. But for a very long time, such godlike people will clearly neither be omniscient nor omnipotent, so there will be plenty of adventure and wisdom to remain to seek after in the wider universe. Time enough for love, as Heinlein would say. What about Cass's claim that man longs not so much for deathlessness as wholeness, wisdom, goodness, and godliness? Again, I think this is a false dichotomy. One can long for deathlessness and wholeness and wisdom and goodness and godliness. Defeating death is not the final act of our technological or spiritual quest. It is merely a vital prelude to our further pursuit of wholeness, wisdom, goodness, and yes, even godliness. Surely, all too many people, perhaps most of us, the pursuit of these virtues has been or will be cut short by death well before we have managed to attain them. It is true for genetic engineering, as for all technologies, that some people will misuse it. Tragedies will occur. Given the sorry history of government-sponsored eugenics, it is vital that control over genetic engineering must never be given to any governmental authority, but including such wise people as the President's Council on Bioethics. But to use biotechnology and genetic engineering is not by definition to abuse it. The technology offers a prospect of ever greater freedom for people and should be welcomed by everyone who cares about human happiness and human flourishing. People who take advantage of the fruits of biotechnological progress in the future will not be Frankenstein monsters nor genetic robots. For example, the eugenics in this particular case would work only if we deny people the access to the technology. We will have determined for their future what genes they're going to get. So we're already at the cusp of whatever the C.S. Lewis concerns are. If you say no, we've already then denied these beneficial technologies to all future generations. And I don't know that we are in any moral position to do that as well. And instead, I think that what will happen as these technologies come online, they will be our grateful descendants for whom we have eased the burdens of disease, disability, and early death. They will look back in wonder and perhaps horror at those who would have denied them the blessings of biomedical progress. So to conclude, the defining political conflict of the 21st century is shaping up to be the battle over life and death. On one side stand the partisans of mortality, like Leon Cass and Daniel Callahan, who counsel humanity to go quietly into that good night. On the other stands the party of life, who rage against the dying of the light and yearn to extend the enjoyment of healthy life to as many people for as long as possible. This conflict is brewing because the biotechnology revolution will alter fundamentally human culture, politics, and our very lives. By the end of the 21st century, when the clash of civilization and the war on terror are just depressing historical footnotes, rapid progress in biology and biotechnology will have transformed human life by dramatically increasing lifespans, enhancing human bodies and minds, deepening our understanding of human psychology, creating super advanced industrial and consumer products, and rescuing and restoring the natural environment. Basically, I'm not seeking transcendence. All I want to do is to create a world where we can restore the environment, eliminate disease, and make death optional. All right, sure, there are some risks, but I think the risks are manageable. Besides, nobody ever said the future would be risk-free. The future also brings wondrous new opportunities to cure disease, alleviate suffering and hunger, and lengthen healthy lives. We would be less than human not to seize those opportunities. Thank you very much.
Today we were listening to Ron Bailey, author of Liberation Biology. He was speaking on a panel on transhumanism at the Association for Politics and the Life Sciences, September 1st, 2005, in Washington, D.C. You can listen to the first part of this panel with Larry Earnhardt, also at changesurfer.com. Regular listeners to Change Surfer Radio are no doubt aware of the Cyborg Democracy blog at cyborgdemocracy.net, and that a number of us who have gathered there have begun to discuss techno-progressivism as a way to frame some of the ideas that we've been developing over the years, ideas that I call in Citizen Cyborg, my book, democratic transhumanist ideas, but which not everyone's comfortable with as a set of terms. And so techno-progressivism has emerged as one of these terms that people seem to be attracted to. And we've started also now the technoliberation.net website and the techno-liberation discussion list on Yahoo Groups to organize and think about some of the ideas from these techno-progressive perspectives. I want to read you the mission statement of the techno-liberation website and of the techno-progressive list, because it frames some of the concerns that you might want to engage with us there about. Techno-liberation, using technology to deepen democracy, using democracy to ensure technology benefits us all. Techno-liberation is a welcoming space for conversation, collaboration, organization, and debate among liberal, social, and radical Democrats from around the world, all of whom share the sense that emerging, converging, disruptive global technological developments threaten unprecedented harm, while they promise unprecedented emancipation for humanity. We want to think about the ways in which technology provokes us to rethink and reimagine the left wing of the possible. Techno-liberation is a rainbow coalition that extends beyond the visible spectra. Our participants belong to different communities, work on different problems, bring different histories, temperaments, and hopes to the work we share, emphasize different pieces of the techno-progressive puzzle. We are gathered together to trade ideas, tell stories, make plans, mobilize efforts, identify threats, facilitate progressive developmental outcomes, and share our differences. Many of us are post-naturalist greens and champions of sustainable development. Many of us are secular humanists and post-humanist humanitarians. Many of us are pro-choice feminists and morphological freedom fighters, defending consensual personal genetic, prosthetic, and cognitive practices of self-creation. Many of us are atheists, aesthetes, and non-judgmental people of many faiths and spiritual practices. Many of us are transgendered, queer theorists, biopunks, democratic transhumanists, and psychedelic experimentalists. Many of us are copy fighters, defenders of the creative and genomic commons, enthusiasts of social software tools, free software, open source, peer-to-peer democracy. Many of us are policy wonks, technocrats, world federalists, human rights activists, election reformers, advocates of basic income guarantees and universal health care, leapfroggers, and space enthusiasts. Many of us are champions of consensual science, of genetic science, and evolutionary theory, but none of us are genetic determinists or social Darwinists. None of us are all of these things, of course, but many of us are many of them. And we are all of us inspired and provoked by the connections we find among these struggles and celebrations. Bioconservatives, market libertarians, religious fundamentalists, and retrofuturists are not welcome among us. There are plenty of places, online and off, where we can argue with you, just as there are plenty of occasions to contemplate the real-world consequences of your ideas and values. Techno-liberation is not the place for you. Feel free to listen and lurk and learn, but pick your fights with us elsewhere. This is a safe space for techno-progressives of all kinds and commitments. We are focused here on the extraordinary threats and promises of ongoing and upcoming technological transformations of what has come to be thought of as the human condition. We are all champions of democracy here, and we are all progressives. We are techno-progressives, and we demand nothing short of techno-liberation. And you can find the Techno-Liberation list on Yahoo Groups and technoliberation.net. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.